Thanks very much, David. I don't know about the vigour and vision. I think a bit worn down now, but nonetheless, I'll try. I could either give the short response or the long response. The short response to Denise would be to say that I agree with everything that she said, and I could then sit down. But instead of that, I'll give the long response, which will actually be to go through a PowerPoint that touches on many of the issues that Denise touched on and illustrates the points that she made, as well as exploring a little bit the interaction with the Cutler review as well, and to finish with what the sector needs to have from the Bradley stroke Cutler reviews. So just to summarise, there has been relative neglect of universities by government since 1995, and Denise has touched on these. The dangerous dependence on the income from international students, certainly at our university and most other universities, the income for education of international students is greater than the income that we receive from government for education of Australian students, and that's been a progressive change over time. There's been underinvestment in capital infrastructure. A recent survey from the Group of Eight showed that there's $2.9 billion of required investment in capital infrastructure to bring the standard up from the substandard state that it's currently in. And extended through the whole sector, that would be something well over $5 billion. And low investment in research and development in international terms. So this slide shows the funding gap that's emerged. The blue shows the actual funding in real dollars which has occurred since 1989 to 2006. The shaded area is what would have happened if there had been adjustment according to the number of students, Australian students, being educated in the universities and according to a real rate of inflation. And that gap you see there of about $1.7 billion represents the underinvestment of government funding since that time. Now you can say, well, that's a deliberate strategy to put more load on the students through their HECS contribution, but you can see here that even taking account of the contribution by students for private contribution, the investment per student, or the dollars per student received by the universities, has fallen in real terms since 1989. And if there's no change, the current indexation, which is set at about 2% per year, will lead to a progressive further decrease in the real funding per student. This shows the public spend on tertiary education, with Australia related to the rest of the OECD. The mean of the OECD is here, and Australia is here. And you'll see, you will have heard the well-publicised 4% decrease by Australia in public investment in higher education between 1996 and 2004, compared with a 49% increase in the other OECD countries. This illustrates the student to academic staff ratio from 1990 to 2005, just illustrating the point that Denise made with the progressive increase in that, reflecting the underfunding, some temporary decrease associated with the 2.5% per year additional funding that was contingent upon certain requirements, but overall sitting at about 20 to 1 and set to rise again above that because of what's due to happen over the next few years. This shows some comparative data. Washington University in St. Louis, a ratio there that corresponds to our 20 to 1 is 2 to 1, MIT 4 to 1, Michigan University, a large university, comprehensive, 9 to 1. But more significantly, our partner university in India, that Monash's partner university, has a ratio of 9 to 1, and our partner university in China, not one of the top 4 or 5, rated about number 11, the major university in West China, situated in Chengdu, 60,000 students, very comparable to Monash in size, has a student-staff ratio of 10 to 1, and a wonderful 400-hectare brand-new campus with a digital library and so on that we'd kill for. But it's not just in terms of education, it's also gross expenditure on R&D. Very pleasingly, the most recent figure released very recently from the Bureau of Statistics shows that Australia's gone up to about 2%. So not so far behind the OECD average as it has been, but looking at the countries above, you can see the very major advantage that those countries have had. And in many of those countries, there's ambitions to increase it even further. So the EU, for example, in the Lisbon Declaration, vowed to get their commitment or level up to 3%. That's the total expenditure. The public expenditure from the Australian government has progressively decreased. This figure is actually from the Cutler Review and shows the total Australian public investment in research and research and development falling from 0.75% in 1993-94 down to 0.55% in 2007-2008. And the business expenditure well below the OECD average of 0.95% compared with 1.53% for the OECD average. A major problem that you will hear universities talking about extensively is the lack of full funding of research. The 25% is the increase since 2001 in the amount of the infrastructure funds provided to universities for national competitive grants. The ARC at the same time has gone up by about doubling as a result of the Backing Australia's Ability, and the NHMRC, the Medical Research Fund, has gone up threefold. That was a bit of a false figure and it's come down again, so it's about just over twofold as well. So the infrastructure to support this research has gone up by 25%, and this has led to a huge need for cross-subsidy from other income sources to support the research that's funded through national competitive grants. This just explains the problem. There are two problems. One is that if you receive an ARC grant, and you may have read in the Higher Education Supplement today about somebody giving it back because he just couldn't afford to do the research on the money that was provided, or a project grant from NHMRC, the funding you get covers about 60% of the direct costs. And in addition to that, there's a deficiency in the indirect costs, the cost of the space that's occupied, the cost of the human resource services, the IT infrastructure, the basic facilities for animals and so on, whatever it happens to be. And that problem has been recognised in other countries and addressed by a complex formula in UK, activity-based costing, and by other mechanisms in New Zealand, USA and other countries. The education revolution that we've heard about so far has delivered quite a number of things, some of which have been helpful to the sector and some of which have not. The first has been the abolition of full-fee undergraduate places for Australian students. That has cost the sector something like $150 to $200 million. Our own university would have increased its income from that source next year to about $24 million. They've been replaced by Commonwealth-supported places, which provide about half that. So it has been actually something that's cost the sector quite a lot of money. The HECS rates for science and maths courses has been halved in the hope that it will attract more students to those important areas. It may or may not work. Certainly in Victoria there's been an increase in demand for those courses, but also for a number of other courses, probably more related to a slowing down of the economic situation rather than to that, because HECS hasn't actually been shown to be a deterrent. Increased numbers of higher degree research scholarships, which will eventually be doubled. 1,000 mid-career fellowships, which both of these are very welcome additions, although given what's happening at the moment, I'm not sure where the students will come from for the OPAs. A double number of Commonwealth Learning Scholarships. Funding compacts have been announced, although we don't know what they are. There's been $500 million as a one-off allocation for the Better Universities Renewal Fund. Very welcome, unexpected addition in the last budget, which goes a very small way to address the huge deficit. And theoretically, the Higher Education Endowment Fund of $6 billion is being expanded to $11 billion, although that's not been through all the approval processes and budgeted yet, but that was announced as an intention of the last budget. Universities can charge for student services up to $250 per annum, taking away a huge deficit in funding with the abolition of compulsory amenities fees labelled as a voluntary student unionism legislation. So that will replace about half of that if it passes through the Senate, and we've had lots of reviews. At one stage, it was estimated by Universities Australia that there are 28 reviews and inquiries going on that had a direct impact on higher education. Obviously, the high-profile ones have been the Bradley Review and the Cutler Review, but there have been many other parliamentary reviews, Senate committees and other reviews. There are many inconsistencies in our section. Denise referred to a few of those. So international students can enrol outside the Commonwealth-supported places undergraduate quota. So if you happen to have the misadventure of having been born in Australia, even if you live overseas, you can't buy a place outside quota. If you're actually a Singapore or Malaysian student, you can. Private universities have Commonwealth-supported places and government-subsidised fee help scheme, yet no restriction on fees or numbers for Australian undergraduate places. So if you're a Bond university, you can charge whatever you like for a law student or a medical student or whatever, but you can't do that if you're Monash University, despite the fact we only get 15% of our income for teaching from the Commonwealth. Public universities as a whole receive only 15 to 40% of the income from government, yet have restrictions on these aspects. And we have moved for some universities to offer initial professional qualifications as masters, and these are mostly deregulated in fees and numbers. So there are a range of inconsistencies in the sector at present. So a minimum requirement for a competitive sector is either a substantial increase in government funding with proper indexation according to cost, or through a new system of funding. And we have to wait till Denise unveils her report before we'll know whether there's a more radically altered system towards a more student-centred, demand-driven system where funding follows students or whatever. We just don't know what that's going to say. If this does not eventuate, there must be some level of deregulation, perhaps via a new funding system. So we can't go on with a pincer grip where on the one hand there's a progressive decrease in government funding and on the other there's absolute limitations on what universities can charge. Now, the Universities Australia position is very much in favour of the increased government funding, and we're certainly not advocating more load being thrown on students. But this dual pincer grip is one that is unsustainable. There's a huge need for increased funding for infrastructure. Even $20 billion would be less for 38 universities or 39 universities than Harvard has for one university. Presumably it's $36 billion US has gone down a little bit as a result of a current financial crisis and its investments, but it would still be around $30 billion US. Full funding for research infrastructure costs, and in the short term an increase in the research infrastructure block grant from 20 cents to 50 cents in a dollar would relieve some of the need to cross-subsidise research. And creative use of compacts, we don't know what they mean yet, but to encourage industry engagement and regional economic development. Increased student support, allowing more students from different backgrounds to get into university, and certainly increased support for pathway programs of various sorts, and a coordinated Indigenous program. There are many other things that I could comment on and would be delighted to comment on during discussion, but they summarise how most of the sector would view the urgent situation that applies and very much substantiate many of Denise's comments. Thank you.